Hello and welcome to the Story Grid Podcast. This is a show dedicated to helping you become a better writer. I'm your host, Tim Grawl, and I am a struggling writer trying to figure out how to tell a story that works. Joining me shortly is Sean Coyne. He is the creator of Story Grid, the author of the book Story Grid, and an editor with over 25 years experience. In this episode, we are continuing to do the Q&A. So a few weeks ago, I took some questions via Twitter and Facebook, and I am just peppering Sean with those questions. So for me, it's been a lot of fun to just kind of hit him with a bunch of random questions and hear his feedback, and I think you'll enjoy it as well. So let's jump in and get started. Okay, Sean, so last week we did our very first Q&A episode. Again, I was surprised we had never done this before. And so we've had even more questions come in. So we added to the list that we didn't even get close to completing last week. But we're just going to jump right in and get started. So here's one. What are the values at stake for nonfiction?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, the big value at stake for the for nonfiction is it's... knowledge, right? It's a revelation plot. So in revelation plots, the value is unknowingness to knowledge. So or wisdom. I'm trying to pull up from my brain sort of the four major, you know, points of the knowledge value, but I'm going to just take a stab at it here. The negation of the negation, meaning like the most negative value of knowledge, is believing something to be true that is false, right? So if we believe something to be a truth that is not true, that is the worst possible case because we're kind of lying to ourselves. So that's the most negative. The other negative is understanding that something is untrue, but not doing anything about it. So the most negative is believing an untruth to be true. The next negative is knowing something is untrue and not doing anything about it, not trying to find the truth after it. Now, then we sort of cross the threshold of, you know, the x-axis, if it's a story grid. And the next one that's positive is uncertainty, or what I call cognitive dissonance. And that what that means is that you are starting to believe that your worldview is incorrect. You're getting more and more evidence against your standard operating procedure, and it's causing you distress. That's what cognitive dissonance is. It's when you have two competing ideas going on in your brain, and you're trying to figure out what to do about it. This is the moment right before you make a decision to change your point of view. And then the most positive in the knowledge sort of revelation plot is truth. When you recognize that, you know, a new truth, a new revelation, then you change your behavior based upon that revelation. So if you look at nonfiction in terms of that value, when we read, say, an academic book, and I would say that the Story Grid book itself is sort of it shades on the side of academic treatment more so than, you know, probably any. I mean, it has academic how-to qualities and big idea qualities, but if I were to say, you know, is the Story Grid a nonfiction book for everyone? I would absolutely say no. It's for people who are very, very interested in learning story structure, and I wrote it that way. So when you're looking at the value of knowledge in terms of an academic treatment, it's very much pointed toward building an argument. There's very much a rational sort of building up of, you know, a very logical argument. It's logos driven. Narrative nonfiction, you know, I always break up my nonfiction into four categories. There's academic, which is very for a limited in, you know, audience that knows a lot of background. Then there's the how-to, which is a prescriptive plan to do something like gardening, a gardening book. Then there's narrative nonfiction, which is story-based nonfiction like The Perfect Storm or something like that, or, you know, the Eric Larson books, The Devil in the White City is a terrific narrative nonfiction book. And then the fourth is the big idea nonfiction book. So logos is what drives the academic movement from something that we believe is true, that is not true, to a new knowledge, a new revelation. So academic is logos driven. Narrative nonfiction is pathos driven, which means story driven. So it's using story to convey the controlling idea throughout. So for example, the narrative nonfiction story, The Devil in the White City, is about evil posing as good. Beware of, you know, doctors who pretend as if they're good because they may have evil intentions.
Well, so, I always thought like narrative nonfiction would basically be just one of the fiction genres.
Yes, it is. But the difference is that there is underneath the revelation nonfiction internal genre that there's a controlling idea within the narrative nonfiction. It's not just telling the story of the doctor who it turns out to be a serial killer. It's also telling sort of a warning to the reader that they should beware of, you know, believing wholeheartedly in a professional, you know, disguise. That the revelation is beware of, you know, even your doctor, because there have been really bad instances of doctors taking advantage of people because they placed their full trust in them. So the big idea, of course, is a combination of ethos, logos, and pathos. And that's why we love it so much. It takes conventional wisdom and proves it wrong through using story, pathos, the hard work of the writer, journalist. That's the ethos part. And then the logos part is the rational explanation using factual information and supportive information to build the case.
Okay. So there's one here that I'm going to have trouble pronouncing. All right. Is it Deus Ex Machina?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
Did I say that right? Okay. Is that ever a good thing to use in your story?
Well, no, I don't think it is ever a good thing in a story.
Well, can you explain what it is first, you know, for other people? Because I obviously know what it is.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah, just by the way you pronounced it. Was okay, Deus Ex Machina is a technique that happened back in Greek theater. So the ancient Greeks, they used, they had, you know, their belief system and their spiritual beliefs were in gods. And they believed that there were terrestrial or extraterrestrial god-like figures who intervened in everyday human capacity. So the playwrights of the era, they would set up these dramas based upon human, you know, foibles and interactions. A lot of them were social dramas about, you know, people getting married or shame of the family or whatever. And so what would happen is by the third act, the ending payoff of the story, because they had this belief system in gods, they would literally bring a god down from the sky onto the stage to decide, you know, the resolution of the story. So you would have Zeus descend from the rafters and he would say, now you're going to marry him, he's going to marry her, and you two families are going to split the property. I'm just making this up. But what that would do is resolve the entire story using a godlike figure as the arbiter of what is right and what is wrong. So Deus Ex Machina today is frowned upon because we don't live in a super spiritual, metaphysical world today. And our belief system is very much in humanism. So bringing a god on stage to decide the fate of, you know, a story would really disappoint your audience. We live in an era in which we believe people solve their own problems, there's rational thought, et cetera, et cetera. So a Deus Ex Machina ending, even for a contemporary dystopian fantasy, is a bad idea. And it's a bad idea because it is unbelievable to contemporary audiences. Now, if we were, you know, having this podcast in Aristotle's time, that would absolutely be wrong. My suggestion not to do Deus Ex Machina wouldn't make any sense, because that culture and that society had a full belief system in the power of godlike figures and trusted in external spiritual beings to, even though they didn't believe literally all the time that a physical presence of a god would arrive and point out everything that is wrong in their lives. But what they did believe is that there was another world, another metaphysical world that they could not see, that had strong influence on what happened to people on Earth.
Well, isn't it used? It's not just when you use it for like godlike stuff, right? It's also when you basically just make something up that fixes all your problems. Like, my thing is, I hate when movies, they're stringing out all this weird stuff that's going on. Then at the end, they're like, oh, it's aliens. Just because aliens I guess aliens are like throwing in a god, because exactly, a god can fix anything. I mean, isn't it any time you just kind of throw something in to fix your problems?
Exactly. And that comes, I'll tell you why people use Deus Ex Machina, is because they can't figure out the core scene of their story. They can't figure out the hero at the mercy of the villain scene. And the hero at the mercy of the villain scene is, or whatever the core story, the core event of that particular story is, that is the moment that is very difficult to crack, because we need the protagonist to overcome the much more powerful antagonist by releasing an inner gift in a unique and innovative way. So, you know, when John McClane in Die Hard gets Gruber to laugh for a moment so that he can take out his gun from his back and shoot him, that is using John McClane's particular gift, which is sort of being a wisecracking cop, wise guy that can disarm somebody through their sense of humor. So that works. It's not Deus Ex Machina. There, you know, all of a sudden the Third Army doesn't arrive and take out Hans Gruber. No, it's John McClane who solves the problem. So Deus Ex Machina, a Deus Ex Machina solution to Die Hard would be all of a sudden SWAT team arrives and takes out Hans Gruber and then saves the day. And that would be extremely disappointing to the viewer, because John McClane has to save the day, not a SWAT team, because that's the structure of a thriller. If you don't have your protagonist rise to the occasion and release their inner gift, it defies the purpose of the thriller to begin with, which is a story to reinforce in all of us an understanding that we have internal gifts that have to be released and shared with the world. So even though it seems like, oh, that's a fun movie, Die Hard, and I really enjoyed myself, it does have a cultural significance and a social significance beyond entertainment. And when you eliminate that core event and don't release the inner gift of the hero, it strikes the audience as disappointing. Oh my gosh, I thought this was going to end that way, and then the SWAT team came in? That's no good. So that's why you don't want to use Deus Ex Machina, because what it does, you know, I saw a Batman movie, maybe it was the third Batman, where there's Catwoman in it. And And Catwoman ends up saving Batman, which was Deus Ex Machina, because wait a minute, she's not supposed to say Batman. Batman has to say Batman. And so that was the third movie in a trilogy that I think Christopher Nolan directed. And I think he might have run out of some gas at the end of it and just said, you know what, just get
that movie had other problems too. But... Okay. All right. So I've got some more kind of, I got a couple kind of more existential ones here to play off the God realm. So,
okay.
What have you, Sean, learned through this process? Have you changed your mind about anything since working with me?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. A ton of stuff. One of the things that's the most difficult thing to learn as an editor is, for lack of a better phrase, something called the bedside manner. And, you know, doctors who are really bad at it, you know, they don't do so well with their patients because, you know, patients get better in, you know, when they have an infection or whatever, when they're psychologically strong. There's a lot to this. So if a doctor has a terrible bedside manner, shows up when somebody's sick and treats them terribly and just wants to sort of get them off of their checklist of their rounds, that actually has a really bad effect on the patient, because then the patient's ability to psychologically repair their illness suffers. So the bedside manner for an editor is really important too, because if you don't take the right approach with the client and help them step by step overcome obstacles without debilitating them, they're just going to throw in the towel. So one of the great things I've learned working with you, Tim, is when to modulate deep criticism, when to pull back, when to push. And that is invaluable information, because there's a tendency for people, just generally, when you know something that other people don't know, you have a great sense of power. And and that sense of power is very, you know, it can make you not do nice things. When we have power, we have to really check ourselves and make sure that we don't abuse it. So there's a lot of editors, a lot of, you know, general people, like somebody like, I just read this article about Carl Icahn, who's this multi, you know, crazy billionaire investor who was an advisor to President Trump for a while until he recently stepped down, and it was in the New Yorker. And it really made this whole sense of power come to my mind in a really strong way, because he was basically trying to abuse his role as an advisor to President Trump, that powerful position, to change a lot of regulations that would make him even more rich and to bring him even more power. And it's a really good article in the New Yorker, I think it's the New Yorker, about just how he did that and how his entire sort of professional career is about building up more and more and more power through accumulation of wealth to the point where he can affect, you know, millions of people with his power. So as an editor, learning how to scale back criticism and dumping things on a client before they're ready for them is a real skill. And I think I've learned how to best approach taking a writer through baby steps of progressions. And the most powerful thing I've learned is really just the importance of scene work. Just how important understanding the fundamental unit of storytelling is. Because once you started to feel comfortable writing scenes, that's when you were ready to start, you know, thinking about bigger elements. Now, everybody, when they start out writing something, they want the answers to the big questions first. Well, what am I doing wrong in the beginning? Why isn't my ending working? And the truth is, you can't answer those questions until you understand the fundamental unit of story, which is the scene. So that's another huge thing I've learned. And that's really I think the primary skill of an editor is being able to analyze a scene and explain how a good scene works very succinctly and using a lot of examples. And the more examples that you can bring to the table that are within the genre of the writer you're talking to, the more that writer will be able to understand it. You need to say the same thing 20 different ways. And the best way to do that is to use 20 different examples from 20 different works within the genre that the writer wants to work in.
All right. Okay, so let's do this one. What do you recommend writers do about writer's block?
Well, writer's block has a couple of components to it. The most obvious component is the resistance to deep thinking. And I was talking to somebody about this the other day, and you know, one of my favorite books over the last 10 years, if not my lifetime, is, and I think we talked about this last week, was Thinking Fast and Slow. And yeah. So we
talked about it a couple times. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's changed my life because the deep thinking requires a lot of energy and it requires a lot of self-examination that is difficult. It's not exactly enjoyable when you're trying to solve a difficult problem. And it's much more difficult even than, you know, higher math skills, you know. So deep thinking, there's a great resistance to it. And I think that's a major part of writer's block because we have been told since we were young that there are certain magical people who are born with talent, and the talent will drive their work, meaning they just have a particular gift to doing something. They might be a tennis, you know, prodigy, or you know, a musical prodigy, and they're just able to sit down at a piano and bang out beautiful music. Well, I don't ever think that has never been true. I don't think that was true for Mozart. I don't think that was true for Beethoven. I think those guys had a proclivity, a love, a passion, and an internal desire to be great musicians. They weren't born out of, you know, the shell with the ability to play the piano in incredible level. I just don't believe it. I think they built that quality at a young age, yes, but they weren't born with that level of proficiency. So because we're sold this bill of goods that some people have writing talent and they were born with it, and when they sit down, they bang out paragraph after paragraph of prose that might not be perfect, but it's editable. I think that's a fallacy. I think people who have a certain, you know, passion to write all face writer's block. They all face this not wanting to go deep, not wanting to self-examine. Because writing is about asking yourself, what do I think about this? If this happened, what do I think would happen next? That's the general idea about writing. You start with an inciting incident. A shark comes to a small, you know, community in the Hamptons and starts killing people. What would the sheriff do? Well, he'd probably try to kill the shark. But what if the sheriff was afraid of the water? Oh, that's even more interesting. What would he do then? So that's where Peter Benchley kind of began. You know, he's probably on vacation thinking, I wonder what would happen if a shark came and started chewing up all these people at the beach. And that's how he started writing Jaws. And there's, you know, any number of examples where that happens. So my advice about how to combat writer's block is to engage yourself. Come up with a whole bunch of inciting incidents. What would happen if, and they can be causal, meaning what would happen if my brother-in-law, you know, asked me for $1,000? Would I give it to him or wouldn't I give it to him? What would I do with that information?
So
go ahead.
In your experience working with authors, because I'm sure, well, let me just not make the assumption. So, you know, working at all the publishing houses you did and all the different authors, I'm sure there were times that like you had an author that you had a contract with that just could not finish the book. You know, because I'm thinking like there's one thing there's to me different situations for writer's block. So there's one where it's like I've set time aside just to write. I'm not really working on a project. I sit down, I can't think of anything to write. And that I feel like is mostly failure of planning. So I've had that situation. What I've found is if I plan ahead, I do what you're talking about, where I list a bunch of ideas. If I have a plan, I can sit down and start working on it. But then there's another type of writer's block, which is I'm halfway through a project and I can't finish it. Like, have you dealt with that with writers? And what do you end up, like, what have you seen them do, or what have you done to get them kind of over that block?
Well, I wish I could say that I could cure people of writer's block, but I can't. And there's only so much, you know, the editor can do for a writer. The writer needs, an editor can work with him developmentally, meaning if the writer has a sticking point, they can, you know, I would always suggest that the writer call their editor and say, hey, look, I just can't solve this problem. And then what happens is, just by the Socratic method of the editor asking questions that, you know, he or she would need to know to be able to help, what it does is it turns on the editorial vision of the writer too. So asking those six core questions that I always talk about is a great way of jumpstarting your work. And not only jumpstarting, but if you're stuck, go back to those six core questions. What's my genre? What are the obligatory scenes and conventions of my genre? What's my point of view narrative device? What are the objects of desire for my protagonist and my antagonist? What is the controlling idea? And what is the beginning hook, middle build, and ending payoff? Those six questions, if you just, you know, if you get stuck writing scenes. Now remember, a lot of people think writing is only literally writing a scene. And that is not true. Writing is also contemplating the vision of the book. Steve Pressfield just finished up a really great series called In the Trenches, where he's been writing at stephenpressfield.com about facing these problems that we're talking about right now. He wrote a manuscript. He sent it to me. I told him he had some pretty substantial problems with the manuscript, which sent him sort of over the cliff. And the last seven posts have been how he's started to climb back that up that cliff. And he's at the top now, and he's working hard, and he's setting down each day's writing goal. But he wouldn't say, oh, just because I haven't been writing scenes, I'm not writing. What he would say is, I'm out in the trenches trying to solve some problems with the manuscript that doesn't work. So there's a big fallacy that writer's block includes the moments when you're contemplating the work and planning the work, and that's not true. A writer is writing when he's thinking about the editorial vision too. So I think your original thing was, how do you get somebody out of writer's block? And if I ever did, the problem with editors at major publishing houses is that they just don't have the time to do developmental editing with people. They're not being paid to get a writer out of the writer's block. They're paid to go find the next writer, the next manuscript. And I'm not faulting the publishing houses for that, you know, structure. That's just a business. It's a business over there. So my advice to writers is find someone, even a fellow writer, who you can, you know, shoot the shit with and go through those six core questions when you get stuck. That's a way of getting out of writer's block. Sometimes another writer's block problem is when you come up with a really mediocre idea and you've committed a lot of work to the mediocre idea and you've hit a reckoning. You've hit the reckoning point. And the reckoning point is when you say to yourself, Robert McKee once, I overheard him give advice to somebody one day, and I don't know how he put it, but this guy went through this long explanation of what his screenplay idea was and how he'd been working on it for 4 years. And McKee, you know, he looked at him and he goes, the problem is that you have an elephant, you know, pulling, you know, like a little toy truck. Your inciting incident is just not that thrilling. And you've built all of this stuff around this inciting incident that is much larger than what your initial inciting incident was. So you really need to throw out the inciting incident and come up with a new one that will support the elephant pulling the cart or start all over again. And it was a moment of revelation for this guy when he felt so good because he got really, really intelligent, quick advice that got him to stop fitzing and futzing on something that just was never going to work. So those are writer's block problems too.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. And I think this is why, because I listened to an interview with Malcolm Gladwell a while back, and he's like, I don't deal with writer's block. He said, you know, he had a job at a newspaper and writer's block was not an excuse that your editor liked. but I feel like there's like different things here because I remember the story of from On Writing where Stephen King was stuck on The Stand, like halfway through The Stand for weeks. And he would go out for his walks and then eventually it like popped in his head how to fix the story and he was able to go do it. And then other times I feel like I get blocked just because I'm afraid of the work. So, you know, I think having, you know, especially working with you and stuff like that, having somebody that can like help you, you know, when you're just being scared, they can tell you to just, you know, cut to it and start writing because you're just scared, or like help you think through because there is that underground subconscious work that's going on that you just have to work through sometimes. Okay, so I want to get into some more meaty things about genre. So here's one. Can you talk more about the society genre? Does this lend itself better to a mini plot story with multiple protagonists than an arch plot? Or how do you think about the society genre? And I would say give some examples of like books or movies that are good society genres.
Oh, yeah. I mean, some of my favorite novels of all time are in the society genre. And what they are, when they really work, it's sort of what we were talking about last week in that you kind of have, it's a mini plot with multiple protagonists, but you always have sort of the center of the story. And that's one character that sort of has elements of themselves expressed in other characters. So let me try and give some examples. Society novels are really, they're about talking about very deep social issues at a very human level. So one of the great society novels is Ragtime by E.L. Doctorow. And the reason why that's such a great novel is that what Doctorow did is he came up with a really wonderful idea. You know, back at the turn of the century during the Gilded Age, there was a bunch of crime that happened. And there was a big, big moment in time when there was a woman named Evelyn Nesbit. And she was sort of this showgirl at the Ziegfeld Follies at Madison Square Garden, which used to be in Madison Park around 23rd Street in Manhattan. And she was this beautiful showgirl who was kind of not that bright. But she was married to a man named Harry Thaw. And Harry Thaw was this rich guy from Pittsburgh. And anyway, she decided to start having an affair with Stanford White, who was this famous, famous architect in New York City who designed, actually, Madison Square Garden. And what he did at the top of Madison Square Garden is he created a sculpture of Evelyn Nesbit in the nude. So it was this big, big scandal where it was obvious that he had used the naked figure of his lover to inspire him to do this beautiful statue that's at the top of Madison Square Garden. Meanwhile, Harry Thaw, who's her husband, freaks out and shoots him, kills him. And so there's this huge trial at the turn of the century about whether or not Harry Thaw will be exonerated for murdering Stanford White. And so E.L. Doctorow, you know, he went back to this and he thought to himself, this is an amazing time in America. And how can I best explain the rise of multiculturalism in the United States, where we have immigrants from Eastern Europe coming here who are bringing their culture with them. We've got cleaning people from the South who are disenfranchised African Americans who are working for rich families in Westchester County. We've got this very wealthy, you know, aristocracy that is sort of having all this fun and games while other people are suffering tremendously. And he came up with this incredible novel where he featured a one family from Westchester County and how that family changed from the turn of the century. And so what the society novel is it's an allegory using one core, very, very specific story to be an allegory for an entire culture or society. So for all those who are interested in the society novel, read Ragtime and you'll really love that novel. It's fantastic. There's also, they made a movie of it, which is great too. It's just a stunning piece of, you know, big grand storytelling on an epic scale that features a very, very tight cast that you're sympathetic and empathetic for every single character in the novel, which was a brilliant, brilliant piece of work. The second one, which is on a smaller scale, but no less large, is, of course, George Orwell's allegory, Animal Farm. Now, Animal Farm is, I mean, forget about it. It's so brilliant in its simplicity, and yet it is so deep in its description of humanity, and specifically the Russian Revolution. He takes the Russian Revolution. Now, George Orwell was, he was a journalist, a brilliant writer. He was a socialist, and, you know, he was part of the Spanish Civil War. He fought on the side of the Republicans. I'm sorry, not the Republicans. He fought on the side of the socialists. Anyway, he felt disenfranchised by the movement of the socialists when Stalin came to power. And so he wrote Animal Farm to express how that may have happened. So in these characters of these animals in this barn, you know, there's a character that represents sort of this Lenin Trotsky sort of central character named Snowball, who is a leader of this movement. And then there's another figure named Napoleon, who's a, you know, also part of the revolution, who slowly takes power. And he uses this allegory using barnyard animals, and it reads, you know, kind of like a fun little story until you start putting the pieces together and you see, oh my gosh, this is exactly the structure of the Russian Revolution and what happened in Stalinist Russia. So society novels and stories can be very intimidating, and they're all about, usually about major cultural shifts in power. They're all about power. Power shift from one part of society to another. So, for example, in Ragtime, it's about the shift of power from, you know, the very, very wealthy Gilded Age aristocrats to this teeming society underneath that will create jazz. It'll create all the great American things that we all, you know, love about this country, and it's undermining the sort of aristocratic, Gilded Age, centralized wealth era. In Animal Farm, it's all about the Russian Revolution. It's about the workers overthrowing the owners. And then it's a revolution within the revolution that brings them back to a conspiracy in which the workers end up being exploited by their own compadres or comrades, as they say in the novel. So just to recap, society novels are about power, shifts in power, major, and the best way to sort of approach them is to think about them in terms of allegory. And when I say allegory, I always think of allegory meaning telling a simple story that tells a much larger tale. So I don't know much more to say about that without
doing it. I'm thinking like, have you watched The Handmaid's Tale? Would that be a society genre?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
That's a feminist society, like a power deal. Yeah. That's another brilliant work. Yeah. Margaret Atwood. Yeah, it's incredible.
Okay, so I really like this question. How do you go to the, quote, end of the line in a story like The Accidental Tourist? Clearly, the stakes are not life or death. So how do you show a fate worth worse than death?
Okay, there's a little bit of confusion about the values. I'll definitely answer that in a second. But every genre does not rest on life and death.
Let me try to guess at what you're going to say, and then you tell me if I'm right. That's why I want to cut you off. So there's there's the moment, the all is lost moment. There's an all is lost moment in every story, right?
Yes.
Right. So is that a better question? Is like, so we know the stakes aren't life and death, and in a life or death value, the low point is when they're facing death.
Right.
So in a story like The Accidental Tourist, what would be that low point? What would be that all is lost moment? Or am I asking a different question than what you think was being asked?
No, I think you're on to the question and the heart of it. The heart of The Accidental Tourist specifically is about isolation, really. It's about a character whose all is lost moment occurs when he understands that he has built such a safety sort of chamber around his emotional being that he has exiled himself from humanity, and he begins to understand that he's a pathetic creature. He's self-loathing. About Schmidt is another novel that's similar to The Accidental Tourist, where you have a lead character. Also, Is That All There Is? Or, the Jack Nicholson movie.
Oh, that's where you have it gets.
As good as it gets, yeah. So what he faces in his all is lost moment is, if I continue on this path, I will come to hate myself. I will reach a level of self-loathing. And self-loathing is a damnation of sorts. So it's also a love story, and it's about a woman who gets this man out. I think Macon Leary is the lead character. And the woman is a dog trainer. It's a brilliant novel. And the dog trainer, his dog ends up biting everybody. So he has to take his dog to this dog trainer to get him, trained so he doesn't attack people anymore. And she's a very eccentric, idiosyncratic person. And she makes him, really self-examine. And, so his all is lost moment, the negation of the negation for him, is recognizing that if he continues on his isolated exile journey, he will die miserable and unhappy and not really contribute anything to the world beyond the character writes travel guides for Americans so that they don't have to deal with foreign countries when they go to the foreign countries. So he tells them where the Holiday Inns are, where they can get hamburgers, all of the things to protect yourself from other influences of other cultures and people. I mean, it's such a great hook. And he comes to realize that he's got to shake things up. You know, his all is lost moment is, if I continue on this path, I will die like one of those people that they don't find for 6 days because nobody cares about them. So when you're dealing with the negation of the negation in sort of that internal global genre, always think of it in terms as the worst possible thing is it's self-hatred, it's self-loathing that, you know, the character must overcome that level of destruction or they will die miserable and damned.
Okay. How do you track subplot on the foolscap global story grid, or is it not something you're worried about at that point?
No, I don't really do track subplot on the foolscap page, because subplot is really a way to speak in global terms, one of the uses of subplot is either to increase the global plot by sort of putting a spotlight on, if they don't, you know, it's like progressively complicating the global plot to make the consequences much larger if it weren't there, or it's to sort of distract, but fool the reader into thinking they're getting one story when they're really getting another. And the subplot, and this often happens in a performance story. Performance story are like, you know, movies like Rocky, where the viewer is led to believe this is going to be a great boxing movie. I can't wait until the final fight. And they think that the final fight is really what the entire story is about. And that's a little bit of a feint, because the reality is the real story is the redemption plot or the education plot or the maturation plot of Rocky Balboa. So the performance story ends negatively. He loses the fight, but the global story ends extremely positively, where he comes to respect himself. There's another example of a story that rests on the lead character's ability to respect himself and to learn to love himself. So subplots are sort of that's a thing that you want to use to add to your global story more than feature on your foolscap. So if I were doing a foolscap of Rocky, it would be about Rocky's redemption, not about Rocky's fighting at the end. Now, the big fight at the end will be on the foolscap because that'll be a climactic scene, but the real turning point is the redemption story. So, you know, there's no hard and fast rule about what you want to feature on your foolscap page, but my advice is to always err on the side of the core global story, because you got to remember, you got to pick one. One genre is your global story. The global story rules. And if you don't solve the global story problems, no matter how good your subplots are, it won't matter. Now, if you have great subplots and a terrible global story, or just like a global story, it's not going to save the story. But you can have mediocre subplots, but a great global story. Like there's some, you know, in a lot of these long form television shows, there are subplots that are like, that's all right.
But you hang on for those last 5 minutes of the show.
Right, because you're coming back to the global turning points of the global story. Because sometimes, like in Mad Men, there were episodes where you're really kind of like, I don't really like Pete and I don't really care about this subplot. But you hang on because, you know, you want to know what's going to happen with Don Draper.
Okay, so this next one is going kind of deep down the genre hole, but I figure we'll throw it in. So in the action genre clock subgenre, the Story Grid book gives 4 subgenres with different villain types driving the plot. So you have Ransom, Holdout, Countdown, and Fate. in Fate, time itself is the villain, and the example is Back to the Future. Does that last one apply only to time travel stories? How do time and circumstances differ as clock devices and villains? So, okay. So talk about how time is used in the Fate sub genre, and what are your kind of options there, and how do you make decisions when you're choosing between the different clock sub genres of action?
Well, I will say this about the, you know, I don't have my book in front of me, and that is really inside baseball.
And you don't have it memorized?
No, I don't. But Back to the Future was a brilliant piece of work because time is literally the antagonist in that story. And it's hard for me to come up with any more examples that had that characteristic. Now, the Ransom plot is, you know, we all know the Ransom plot. Great movie, Ransom, is a great example of it, where somebody takes kidnaps somebody, and then the clock is, they say, the first Dirty Harry has a ransom plot too. So time as a clock, here's my advice about it. Use the clock element to amplify the global action elements. And usually clocks are involved in things like crime stories, horror stories, and thrillers. The action story is sort of the primal base, if you will, for all of these ones that concern safety. The action story
I think it's like Mission Impossible, right? They got to like do all these things before the bomb hits, right? The nuke goes off or something like that.
And holdout stories are things like 300, the 300, where you've got to have, somebody's got to hold out while other people are regrouping. And how desperate it is, you know, fighting to the last man so that, you know, they can finish the bulwark that will save humanity. And, you know, the Battle of Thermopylae was that moment in Western civilization where it seemed like all was lost. The Persians are taking over. And if the Greeks can't rally, all of Greece will be taken over by Persia, and we would never even have any Greek history or Western ideals or whatever. And so the Battle of Thermopylae was such a pivotal moment. And it was a, you know, to the last man stand, that is the holdout, the ultimate holdout story. But, you know, it's not really, the great thing about Steve's novel, Gates of Fire, which deals with the Battle of Thermopylae, and even the movie, it's not really about the holdout moment. It's about the ethos underneath that compelled those men to take on the mission itself. So I don't really want to get into the, you know, more of the clock elements of the fourth subgenre of action, other than to say, think of the sub-subgenres as little plot device elements that you can add to your story more than the full, you know, Monty of the driver of the antagonism. Have the element of time be an antagonist, but be a supporting antagonist as opposed to the full antagonist. Because if you use time as the full antagonist, what it becomes is really heady. There's a novel that Martin Amis wrote called Time's Arrow, which is a perfect example of this, where it's so heady, meaning difficult to follow and understand the projection of time, that you lose the ability to really enjoy the entertainment because you're trying to, well, if that happens and if Marty McFly's mother was really, if she does have relations with, you know, like it's ridiculous. You start to overwhelm yourself with the what ifs. That's why Back to the Future was so great, because it had this element of antagonism that usually spells disaster that actually worked.
Okay, so let's end on this one. Is there an ideal time to engage an editor or beta readers for your story?
Well, there's one of two ways of doing it. I, you know, once you have a draft that you sort of throw up your hands and say, you know what, this I can't really tweak this anymore. I need to get feedback. That is the time to, I'm not a big believer in beta readers unless they're editors that you're paying, because beta readers can really send you off the rails. Because I'm not saying that they don't have a great story sense, because everybody does. What happens often, though, if you're dealing with somebody who's not a professional editor, or even a professional editor, is that once you hand them the manuscript and they read it and they come back to you with notes, their interpretation of what you have written is often differs than your intention. So it's a good idea to engage an editor who will, before they give you their notes, you know, have them do their homework first and then have a phone call with you first to talk about what your intentions were. Because then that can direct them in helping you, you know, get your intentions, you know, more clear on the page. That might seem a little strange, but what I think is a great technique, and it's what I do now, is especially for writers that I don't know who hire me, and trust me, I don't take many of these on if I can help it, is that if you're the editor and you don't know what the intention of the writer is, the problem is that oftentimes you will see a kernel, or what you see as the global genre of the story is actually not the intention of the writer. And so you'll start giving them advice about writing a crime novel when they really wanted to write a redemption story. And so you start pushing them on the crime stuff, and then the crime overwhelms the redemption story, and then the intention of the writer gets thrown away, and then the writer, you know, mysteriously through two rewrites starts to lose their love of the project. Because what they really wanted was to write a redemption story. So if you have an early conversation with them and say, hey, what's your global genre? What's your global goal here? What do you really want to write about? And if the writer says, well, I want to talk about how somebody who's really screwed up their life returns to a state of grace, then the editor is going to know, oh, this is a redemption story. But if they say, oh, I want to do this really great mastermind plot where this criminal, you know, plans the perfect murder and almost gets away with it, then the editor goes, oh, they want to write a crime story. But if you don't have that conversation, you can get confused as the editor and give, you know, contrary advice to what the writer really wants to do. So my advice about when the best time to seek an editor is either A, when you have a complete draft and you don't know what else to do with it, or B, when you have an idea and you have some notions and you want to get some advice about how to move that idea and notion forward in a way that will make sense. Sort of like the way you and I have been doing the Story Grid podcast, where you had some global notions after we had to throw away that first draft, and then we built it from there. It took a long time, but it was, you know, I think you are much closer to a publishable novel now than you would have been if you had tweaked that first manuscript until you were blue in the face.
So how do you feel about writers groups? So I was listening to this class, this online YouTube class by Brandon Sanderson, who's a very prolific writer. And he talks about writers groups, and he talks about how he, you know, when he was in college, I'm going to not get the specifics right, but basically when he was a young writer, he was in this writer's group and they really stuck it out together. And now like 4 out of 5 of them are, you know, writing professionally and whatever that means. And so, but then I have always kind of shied away from it. And now, you know, for all those listening, rolling their eyes, I know like I'm pretty lucky because I get Sean to look at my writing and not everybody gets that. But I've always kind of shied away from it because I feel like, why do I want to ask other amateurs that don't know what they're talking about any more than I do their opinion on my writing? So So how do you feel about writers groups, and if people are going to do them, like what's the right way to go about them? Would love your input on that.
Well, it's like anything else. You don't want to get into a group of people that sole purpose is to, you know, get in a pissing contest about, you know, who's a better writer. And unfortunately, a lot of, you know, I'm probably going to take a lot of heat for this, but I think most of the MFA programs are incubators for discontent. You know, they're places where people who don't really know writing craft get to take pot shots at each other, you know, every single week. And I think, you know, the end result is everybody wants to get teacher's approval, right? There's always this brilliant, you know, novelist who's running the MFA program, and everybody vies for that person's approval. So my advice is that a writer's group, unless you're really close friends and you really care about each other, and hopefully you're writing in different genres, because you can undermine each other, you know, subconsciously. If you're all trying to write Sherlock Holmes stories, oh, that can be just a recipe for disaster. The other thing that I think is important is that there's value traded here, right? So if you know an editor who has a lot of value and they want to be a writer too, and you're trading value for their editorial advice, you know, I think the best situation is where you can find an editor who is not emotionally invested in your work beyond wanting to help you get better, and you pay them and they help you step by step through the process and give you legitimate advice that they can use a lot of examples to back up. So that's why I'm a great believer in the story grid methodology. It's because it uses very, very clear principles as critical tools. I can't just say to you, Tim, I didn't like the third scene. Well, why? I don't know. It just seemed kind of flat. That's terrible. What was that? What are you going to do with that? And that's the advice we get from writers groups all the time. You know, if you're in a writers group and everybody says to you, you know what, your inciting incident's a little weak, and then you never progressively complicate, and I don't see a clear crisis here, and it all seems as if you're writing at the power of two in all your progressive complications, and I think you need to raise the stakes until they're irreversible, and that time comes right, you know, at the major moments of your act shifts. Hey, that's, you know, shit. I would love to hear that kind of advice. I just don't think it's out there. So one of the ways to see whether or not the writers group is going to help you or not is to listen to the way they talk about the work. If they're talking about it in terms of, well, I just didn't feel it was all that, you know, hooky to me. Now, you know, you don't need that. That's not going to help you. What you need is very specific advice that cites story structure principles over and over again. Somebody says to you, your inciting incident doesn't work. You know how to fix that. You go out and you think of another inciting incident. Somebody says you're not progressively complicating to an irreversible point. You know how to fix that. You know you got to keep upping the stakes on the progressive complications until there's a moment when it's irreversible. They can't go back. Now they've got to move forward. There's the point of no return. And so if you get that advice in your writers groups, great, take it. But if you don't, find somebody who will give it to you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Story Grid podcast. For everything Story Grid related, check out storygrid.com. Make sure you pick up a copy of the book and sign up for the newsletter so you don't miss anything happening in the Story Grid universe. If you'd like to check out the show notes for this episode or any past episodes, all of that can be found at storygrid.com/podcast. If you would like to reach out to us or submit a question for a future Q&A episode, you can find us on Twitter at StoryGrid. Lastly, if you would like to support the show, you can do that by telling another author about the show and by visiting us on iTunes and leaving a rating and review. Thanks for subscribing and being a part of our work here at StoryGrid. We will see you next week.